Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, it's a Google Festival, Pixel XL, Daydream VR Home, and more. Intel Core i7-7700K, massive boost or bogus benchmark leak, how curved is two curved Oculus updates, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 384, recorded October 6, 2016. Google's Festival of Hardware and 7700K Rumors.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. Introducing the all-new ProTek Toolkit to give you the compact and complete toolkit for all things DIY. For $5 off your purchase of $10 or more, go to ifixit.com/twit and enter the code TWITCH at checkout.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most engaging, most delightful, most informative, and in this case, darkest, most poorly lit video about hardware. Oh my goodness. I apparently need to relight my kitchen, but that's a whole nother story.
It looks all right. No, I think it looks okay. It's accent lighting. It's like dramatic. See me, I have this single overhead CFL kitchen light illuminating me, washing me out. You, I feel like your lighting gives your setting like detail and interest and intrigue. Yeah, there you go. See there, you can blow it out too if you want.
Oh my goodness. The reason I'm recording at home and the strange lighting is because I'm heading to Rocky Mountain Audio Fest in about an hour and 15 minutes. That's a big, giant audio gathering in Denver, Colorado, which I'm pretty excited about. Talk to you guys about that next week. Galaxy S7, the rumor, the reporting right now suggests that there are Galaxy S7 or notes that have been returned. Or these are like the exchange, the new, the ones with the batteries that aren't supposed to blow up. And we have two separate incidences of Galaxy Notes. One apparently lighting itself on fire inside of a Southwest aircraft because life isn't dramatic enough. So we don't have a lot of confirmation or comments from Samsung as of the last 30-40 minutes, but that's a big deal. And if you are carrying one of the new inflammable Note 7s, you might want to consider leaving it at home temporarily. The Motorola G, lovely piece of hardware for a small amount of money to tide you over while you're waiting for an exchange. And unfortunately, the rumor is that two of the exchange phones have self-ignited, caught fire, exploded. I hate to use the word exploded without actually knowing there was an explosion. One could argue that it is a particularly good time in the world of Android for Google to launch Pixel, which is their in-house manufactured, not just in-house branded and built by somebody else phone. So Pixel's replacing Nexus, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Have you seen these new Core i7-7700 benchmarks that have been floating around? The first ones I saw were like WCCF Tech, and they're claiming like 40% boost in single-threaded performance, 20% gain in multi-threaded performance over Skylake, I believe using the same chipsets. Mm-hmm. Is it too early for this kind of results, or do you think these are overclocked? Because my first thought was like, man, I bet these are overclocked to snot and back.
Yeah, that seems a little high, right? So what right. I know about Kaby Lake, it will use the same chipset. It will use Z100 mm-hmm. series chipsets with a firmware update. ASUS actually posted a thing on their website where, you know, here's all the boards that will support the Intel next generation processors. And it was all of them as far as I could tell. The 7700K, the next Kaby Lake part, which I don't think is going to be out until maybe CES timeframe is my guess. Right. I would be shocked if it were 40% higher clock speeds or higher performance.
That would be epic.
Yeah, I mean, it would be amazing. It would really be a negative for AMD's Zen launch that would be happening in the same timeframe as Kaby Lake. I think if you look at what the mobile processors for Kaby Lake talked about, like they launched at IDF, the 15-watt parts. What you're seeing is like a 3 to 5 bin, or aka 3 to 500 megahertz improvement in clock speeds. At the same TDPs, at the same kind of IPC levels, there's literally zero IPC change going from Skylake to Kaby Lake. So all these improvements that they're talking about would have to be in terms of clock speed. And to get 40% improvement, you know, you're talking a 40% improvement in clock speed, which for a 3 gigahertz part is going to be, what is that, 1.2 gigahertz difference or so, which would be pretty substantial. I think the 20% range is probably possible. And again, you've got to look at it in terms of single-threaded workloads, bursty single-threaded workloads, workloads that take a lot of stuff up front but then are very quick. Those are where you'll see improvements in that type of architectural change. The kind of workloads where you're doing transcoding for 30 minutes or something like that, you're going to see a less dramatic increase in performance because the 3 to 5 clock speed bin will probably settle down to maybe 1 or 200 megahertz better over a long period of time as the processor tends to heat up and that type of stuff. So I would be shocked if this is, if the 40% thing is real. Are they using Geekbench on this again? It looks like they are.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, like, I'm looking at Core i7-7700. Well, this is, 7700K is running at 4.2 gigahertz, 7700 at 3.6 gigahertz, 7700T at 2.9 gigahertz. So, you know.
If these leaked slides or the leaked table, I guess, on WCCF Tech is true, the 7700K is a 4.2 gigahertz core clock. Now, they don't, I assume that means that's it's the top boost clock of that processor, not the base clock of that processor. Assuming that's the case, you're only looking at it being a couple of hundred megahertz faster than the Skull Trail, or what was it? Was that what it was?
That sounds about right.
Well, yeah, the 4790K, whatever that part's nickname was. Now, that being said, that's about, like, that's 400 megahertz higher than the 6700K. So, I mean, there will be some improvements courtesy of just, hey, they figured out the process technology a little better. They figured out the architecture a little bit better, so they know how to tweak things a little bit better. But I don't expect 40% across the board on these types of things. Maybe in an outlier, but not anything across the board.
I mean, we have seen Intel do some crazy stuff. For example, a 50% boost in battery life when moving to a new chip that they just kind of had up their sleeve. So, you know, there is a far end of the bell curve possibility that it's going to be that much faster. You know, maybe they've been sitting on it for VR and mass desperation, but I'm with you. I think that would be shocking. Amazing, but shocking. Somewhat less shocking given how often and how heavily it was teased in the last few weeks. Pixel, the new phone by Google, pre-orders started the morning of Pixel's announcement. As a matter of fact, Shannon, my co-host on Tech Thing, actually saw that they were talking about the phones, found a buried link on the Google Play Store, bought the phone, the XL version of the phone, and then went back to find out what she'd bought for testing, which I thought was so delightfully committed. But, you know, they're making a big deal of Google Assistant being built in. They're claiming they have, you know, it's DxO Mark Mobile gave it an 89, which is even higher than the iPhone 7's camera. But, you know, big fat pixels and a 12 megapixel sensor. So they're claiming excellent low light performance. You know, 1.55 micromillimeter. I don't remember the UM for pixels. You know, same f2.0 aperture. We've seen an awful lot of cameras. I thought it was interesting that it's a 4-core Snapdragon 821 processor, and much like the iPhone 7. And by the way, did you notice it doesn't look like the iPhone 7 at all, or the iPhone 6 for that matter, from a design standpoint? Including the bezel to the left and right of the monitor. That kind of blew me away. I didn't really talk about it. It's finally sinking into me how much this looks like an iPhone. But much like the iPhone 7, it's got two faster and two slower processors. The other thing that they announced yesterday was the Daydream View, which is the Daydream headset that converts the Pixel phones, the Pixel and the Pixel XL into VR devices. And the comes with a remote. So there's, if you can see on the picture of that, if you can hear the bell exploding behind me, that's a four-year-old attempting to get into the house. You know, it's got two buttons and a touchpad on the end. So they're keeping it really, really simple. The aesthetic is extremely stylish. I was laughing. Mm-hmm. It resembles a camera bag we were looking at recently from Peak Designs and a lot of stuff that's showing up this year. I'm a little worried about the toggle they're using to hold the phone in place. You know, the stretchy toggle, but very fashionable, very inexpensive. And remember, it's $79 just for the headset and remote. You still have to have, you know, a $650 phone to stuff in there. So specs are looking good on the Pixel and the Pixel XL. I'll be curious to see what the real world performance is like, what the low light performance is like on that camera. It's interesting. And yes, kids, it does have a headphone jack. So several other announcements. You know, do us a favor, tweet at Ryan Schrader, at Patrick Norton, if you want us to get deeper into the Pixel phone territory. But it seems like, you know, Google's tired of not having a lot of phones running a, you know, plain Android, plain vanilla Android environment and having to deal with everybody else. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how LG and Samsung and others respond to Google's wholehearted entry into the market. But nice looking phones. Be really curious to see what the battery life, the real world battery life is. They're claiming like 13, 14 hours on battery life, which would be a huge difference over the iPhone 7, especially with some of the real world reports we're getting on iPhone 7 battery life. But
right.
Yeah. Talk about Google Home and the new Chromecast in a minute, but what's going on? So is NVIDIA going to leave graphics behind, or are they just, it's just one of those classic NVIDIA huge announcements that may not actually turn into anything? Is that rude?
We're talking about the Xavier SoC stuff, yeah. Right? This is really a continuation of their attempt to get into the autonomous vehicles, mm-hmm. self-driving cars type of thing. Remember at was it GTC or CES or one of those shows, they announced that they had like the Drive PX, and then they announced Drive PX2. And these are platforms that they built specifically to kind of sell to car manufacturers, sell to vendors kind of developing autonomous driving, saying like, look, we have the GPU compute horsepower to really make autonomous driving like kind of the necessary compute capability to make that happen in a real-time basis. And NVIDIA's Xavier design apparently is just the next iteration of it. Now, it's worth noting mm-hmm. that this is a far future type thing, like late 2017 type timeline, right? So this is it's an 8-core custom ARM SoC. Mm-hmm. They don't mention how custom it is or what kind of architecture it is. It's using Volta GPU cores, which is the next generation GPU after Pascal. Like this is the first time Volta has kind of been shown not just in a roadmap. Right, this is the first time it's being shown as a product, but they didn't show performance, right. They didn't show anything else. This is like, okay, there's going to be 512 Volta cores. That really means nothing to us at this point because we have no idea
how Volta that relates cores. To
they're going to be better than Pascal. And what the only thing that I can take away from this is if you look at that table again, you'll notice that Drive PX2, mm-hmm. they list TOPS, TeraOPS. Now this. It's vague on what that is, and we assume that they're comparing similar teraops across different architectures. They might not be. But note that the Drive PX2, which is a dual Tegra X2 platform, uses 250 watts. The NVIDIA Xavier architecture is slightly lower than that at 20 teraops, but is only using 20 watts of power. So the power reduction on that is incredibly significant. Now, there are all kinds of other things that might go into that, right? Like the teraflops mm-hmm. rating right above it where we have a question mark at NVIDIA Xavier might be very, very low. Like maybe these GPU cores are designed specifically for this specific visual computing. What term am I missing? I keep stepping over here. The computer vision operations, right? As opposed to general purpose floating point type stuff. And maybe they've been able to optimize specifically for that. And that's how they're able to get the wattage down, the power draw down, while maintaining a sizable performance delta on those teraops per second ratings. So it's interesting to see them talk about it, but if we put this in the same vein as the Tegra line of products, NVIDIA continually talks a ton about Tegra, about its mobile SoC, where it was in smartphones, where it was in tablets, where it was in gaming devices, where it was in set-top boxes with the Shield, and now with the self-driving car stuff. We just really need to see implementation first before we get more excited. And you know, one of the things I would say, like, car vendors, other than Tesla, are not generally super interested in like dramatic architectural shifts on a year-to-year basis, right? They don't. They tend to not work in that cadence. But at some point, maybe NVIDIA is just iterating fast enough, hoping that there will be the right product that, you know, Ford and Chevy sink onto, and you ride that for the next few years as well. So that's probably part of what their plan is.
It'll be interesting to see how that turns out. There is so much exploding, and so many of the car vendors now are trying to accelerate the adoption of autonomous vehicles or the rollout of autonomous vehicles. I'll be really curious to see how that ends up. GeForce GTX 1050 Ti based on Pascal GP107. One of the things we've been talking about in the last couple of weeks is that finally the NVIDIA GPUs seem to be available at or under their MSRP, in most cases under their MSRP. You know, GTX 1050 Ti, kind of the latest, the latest round of rumors to come over the fence. VideoCards.com says that it looks like the GTX 1050 Ti is based on a new Pascal GP107 GPU, 4 gigabytes of GDDR5 memory, 6-pin power connector, and very little hard details other than that.
That's pretty much all at this point. I mean, it's a very tiny GPU. The board that they have pictured here shows a 6-pin power connector, but my understanding is that some of the stuff we've seen before this has shown no 6-pin power connector. So similar to what the 750 Ti was in terms of how you could plug that into older machines that had, you know, aging power supplies, didn't have 6-pin power, you didn't have to depend on a very high-quality power supply or anything like that.
Right.
The 1050 Ti was probably going to target that same audience. But we did see 750 Ti's come out with 6-pin power from, like, add-in card vendors. But I expect we'll see some of each at that point if that works out to be the case.
October 18th launch, expected to price $150, 768 CUDA cores, 48 TMUs, 32 ROPs, and running at like 1,318 megahertz, boosting up to 1,392 megahertz. I'll be curious. You know, GTX 1050 is supposed to launch at $119 with 640 CUDA cores. I feel like these are basically 1080p, you know, nice 1080p GPUs.
And we just keep getting nicer and nicer ones. Really, right? 1080p is still going to be the target resolution for a while. Like, that's where the main bulk of the audience is. So improve what they can get at lower prices.
I'm not going to say no to that.
Exactly.
And I'll just look sadly at the 950 right over there, which was lovely when I bought it about 4 weeks too early. Ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank our sponsor, iFixit.com. They are your complete DIY electronics repair solution from their 21,000-plus free step-by-step repair guides and more than 80,000 solutions. That means things you can fix. My screen is broken. My home button doesn't work. I need to replace the glass on my LG G4. To the huge inventory of replacement parts and tools with lifetime warranty, iFixit has got your repair needs covered. Today, we are talking about one of the most useful things in my toolbox, the all-new ProTech Toolkit. It is gorgeous. They scrapped the old design, reimagined it, made it more usable, more ruggable, just as portable as before. I think even more rugged. I think ruggable. I think it may be my new word. It's ruggable, man. Rugged and portable. Is your watch ruggable? Are these headphones ruggable? easier to use. Tools are easier to access because the way they laid everything out. A big part of that's a new 64-bit driver kit. Replaces the former 54-bit driver kit. No hinges, no latches. You don't have to pull it out of its holder on the tool roll. It's held on by magnets. The lid is held on by magnets. So you open up the tool roll. You pull the lid off. You can start throwing parts into it. You know, it's actually held on the tool roll with magnets, so you can use the magnets in the tool roll to hold your screws as you're pulling stuff apart. More bits means fewer repair roadblocks, easier to use, longer lasting. A really nice redesign on the swivel top precision driver, and they got that flex extension to get in those hard-to-reach screws, like down in the corner of the case where you can't get a straight screwdriver in there. Bend this thing around. It is unbelievably useful, especially if you have some of the less fortunate case designs like I do. Precision ESD-safe tweezers, including a pair of reverse tweezers so you can snatch things, a wider variety of plastic opening tools and picks to safely work on tablets and smartphones, a suction cup for display assembly removal, a metal spudger and iFixit's own rubber-handled Jimmy Pry tool, which I most recently used as part of tearing apart a perfectly innocent remote control. We'll talk about that later. ESD safety strap if you're old school or new school or just don't believe in destroying your jobs with static shock. Best of all, ladies and gentlemen, it is backed by iFixit's lifetime warranty. Buy it because it's awesome or don't. You still get free access to all of the free repair resources on iFixit.com. But if you do buy it, not only will you help iFixit create more of these amazing repair resources, these guides up on the iFixit.com website, you will not only get an all-new ProTech toolkit, we can score you a discount. Head over to iFixit.com/twit and use the code TWICH at checkout to save $5 on your purchase of $10 or more. We want to thank iFixit for their support. And I know you're listening. You got something to fix. Do yourself a favor. Go check out the all-new ProTech toolkit and take advantage of that discount. iFixit.com/twit and use the coupon code TWICH. Get yourself a discount, people. And back to the launch of Google. They just announced everything. Google Home, the shortest way to put it, is Google is trying to put one foot on top of the Amazon Echo and one foot on top of the Sonos. I thought that was kind of I was expecting them to do a voice-controlled home system at some point. I didn't expect them to. I'm very, 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 very curious to hear the speakers on it, right? Because one of the things you can do is you can chain multiple Google Homes together, like a Sonos, to play music around your house. Obviously, I'm a little music-centric. They have integration with if this, then that. A whole bunch of home automation stuff built in. Not as much, say, as some of the Harmony remote or some of the more advanced stuff out there. But again, this is just about the launch. Very big on the sort of the conversational. It's always listening. Okay, Google, play dance music on my living room TV. Okay, music from YouTube playing on living room TV. You know, it's like, they're calling the speaker hi-fi, high excursion speaker. It's a small speaker, but the idea is that it has a very, very long stroke, and that will give it some advantages in creating bass over a typically engineered speaker in that size range. I'm really curious. I think part of the funnest thing I saw is if you click on the features tab on the madebygoogle.com/homepage, it'll give you a big sort of punch button collection of all of the features on it. Manage tasks, plan your day, questions you can answer, ask it, alarm, shopping list, timer, you can ask it dictionary questions, facts and info, finance, sports, local weather, your calendar, flight information. I'm really curious what the built-in Easter eggs are going to be like, because they're asking you to ask, how old are you? What am I thinking right now? Or count by 10. One can only imagine what my 4-year-old could do getting the internet to count by 10 for him over and over again. Tell me something interesting is under the delight section of the features. But obviously, Google, I don't think, has gotten where they want to go with Nest, and they have sort of pulled everything internally and are ready to do a big honking battle for control over your home with Amazon. Be very curious. Also be very curious to see how well it works controlling, running, streaming stuff to my television or to my various devices in my house and whether this is as remotely open as it needs to be to destroy and take over the world of the universe, the world of the home universe, home automation universe. Google Chromecast Ultra. The two existing Chromecasts stay, the Chromecast 2 and the audio, and they're adding in the Ultra for $69, so 4K UHD and HDR. My understanding is HDR10 and Dolby Vision, which is a big plus. It will stream all the things. It's going to be shipping in, I believe, November for $69. A lot of people were shocked at the jump in price over the previous Chromecast devices. But the other thing that's happening is the Google Play Store is getting a whole bunch of 4K content. So I'm kind of wondering if they were offsetting the cost of acquiring or encoding that content in 4K. You know, other than that, it's Chromecast. They claim it's 1.8 times faster than the existing Chromecast devices. So if you feel your Chromecast is a little pokey, this could be a way to speed up your lifestyle. We shall see. We shall see. Obviously, Roku also came up with a bunch of 4K HDR-ready devices in the last couple of weeks. So the only one left that doesn't do anything is Apple. But, you know, they want to make sure you buy as many 1080p Apple TVs before you move on to the
of course,
the 4K version of that. So
of course.
They've got it, man. but be interesting to get a hold of those and see how well it works. Yeah, it should be HDR and Dolby Vision. So hopefully it's HDR10 and Dolby Vision. Although that battle seems to be settling itself out slowly, which is a nice thing. And if you want us to get deep into the whole art and science of HDR support and the split standards, we'll get Robert Heron in here to talk more about that. Yep. Have you played around with some of the curved desktop monitors?
I have, yes. Okay. Not this Dell one, obviously, this new one, but I still think curved displays make way more sense on a PC than they do on a TV.
I agree.
So that seems to follow with what we've got here. And Dell Ultra Sharp monitors are still considered among the best, highest quality displays that you can find. So those are good things, right? This is a $1,200 Ultra Sharp 34-inch curved display U3417W.
Yeah, that's the update to the U3415W that came out last year. Like the 3415W, which is selling for anywhere between $650 and maybe $950 or $1,000, depending on where you're shopping. It's a 34-inch monitor. It's much more the update, the 3417W, just a little bit more for using multiple devices on the same monitor, which I'm not going to get into too much at the moment because I don't think any of them work particularly well. But it's a 21:9 monitor. WQHD resolution. So it's most of a 4K monitor, but it's about 400 pixels short on the width of a 4K monitor and a whole bunch more pixels short on the height of a 4K monitor. I love splitting the screen into three sections. I've been using this one for a while. But I've noticed it is much more curved than the 3415 was. The 3415W had like a 3800R curve, which is basically a 3.8 meter, the radius of a 3.8 meter circle. And the UltraSharp 3417W has a 1900R is basically the radius of a 1.9 meter circle, which means it is about twice as curved. And gotcha. I did not really notice the curve. Right. You know, I agree that it kind of makes sense, you know, when you're sort of an arm length away from it. But I felt I noticed the curves, especially when I was dealing with a lot of square boxes on the screen, i.e. That thing we call windows. So I got to say, I think I'm a little a bigger fan of the more shallow curve or the curve of a larger radius. Other than that, though, fantastic monitor. Let's see. Let me just double check. 3800R. Yeah, 3415W is a 3800R curve radius on that. But really fantastic for gaming if you've got the GPU for it. And these are really bright monitors. You know, not deck of a boat at the equator bright, but they're a pretty honest 300 candelas per meter squared. which means I am getting way more light than I want after the sun sets in the evenings. So modulating the temperature on that has been important for me. So just wanted to say that it's they're both great monitors. Keep an eye out because those 34Ws, U3415Ws, seem to be showing up for some really low prices at non-Dell sources if you get lucky. I've seen them for as low as $650 to $700, and the new ones selling for closer to $1,200. And that's pretty much where the 3415W was last year when it launched. Good stuff, gotcha. Though. I like them. It's a little. It seems to be easier to drive than a 4K monitor. And not sort of as massive. I'll be really curious also to see. I think it's LG that did the 38-inch curved monitor to see what that thing looks like in the real world. So, oh my goodness. Another cooler review. Sebastian, did Sebastian do the review of the Enermax ETS T50 Axe? No, Jeremy Hellstrom did. Oh, that's right. I was thinking of a different cooler. This is the...
Look at the lights on that thing.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Enermax is a company name that's been around here forever. They have, let's see, they call them circular type LEDs, allow you to make the cooler glow in a variety of colors. It's a little bit smaller than other big towers, apparently 135 by 65 by 160. Mm-hmm. But performance does go down a little bit as a result. Physics is physics. As nobody's ever said, but I just made up, I guess. The reviews actually over at Hard OCP of this, it's a neat looking in terms of the, it's kind of got like a matte black finish to it. The fan mm-hmm. and plastic shrouding for it is all kind of a matte black finish to it as well. And really, if I could have my lights look like that the whole time, I think that might be worth an investment. I don't know. It's so odd. We talked about a different cooler on our podcast last night, and there's just so many of these types of coolers really coming into the market now, and they're all pretty good, right? They're all decent, and they're all kind of within spitting distance of each other. That's the problem, right? Is like if you look at the Enermax, it's kind of the worst performing of it, but it's only 3.5 degrees Celsius worse than the best one in this comparison.
Well, so think about how much heat those LEDs, the five switchable Vegas LED modes, blue, red, green, the three color combo, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, the fifth heat is off. You can do sparkle, all on, flash. I mean, I don't think you're really giving them credit for the fact they've got to get rid of the heat of all those LEDs. They have to have all the additional wiring and control for that.
You're right. I think they should be given credit for it. You're right.
PC Per Gold Award. Just hand it out, man. And they've got one if you're one of those people that has a sort of shiny white case on the interior, like you're getting your Stormtrooper guts on. They have one that is all white too. The ETS T50A WVS. I don't know. I'm always amused at finding new and exciting places where people have put LEDs.
Yeah. We're running out of places, by the way. There will not be very many places to not have LEDs.
We need to send you to Burning Man just so you can realize how many places a person can put an LED without even getting particularly creative.
Yeah.
Zuckerberg says Oculus is working on a mid-price, mid-range Oculus.
Okay.
And the early Sony VR is kind of like the controllers are meh, but it's affordable and it attaches to a console.
I haven't gotten my PSVR yet, but the reviews are like it's okay, right? And that the controllers were definitely the weak point for it. The Move controllers were definitely not built for this type of thing. But it's the most comfortable headset by a significant distance, apparently, which is something that people have been saying for a long time. Today was kind of actually right before the show started. Michael Abrash was finishing up his portion of the Oculus kind of keynote at the, what do they call it? Oculus Connect 3 event. Right. So Oculus Touch will be shipping on December 6th now. Pre-orders going up on October 10th. It's $199 for the two controllers. But if you want a second camera, that will allow you to go into a room scale form factor. And it's another $79 on top of that. So you're looking at $279 total for that package, which kind of puts it right in line with, actually a little bit more expensive than where the HTC Vive launched at. The controllers on the Oculus Touch do seem to be a little bit more advanced. They have the potential to be a little bit more interesting. They have sensors on all the buttons so they know if your hands are on them, not just if you're depressing them. So if you have your hands up like this and you're holding the controller and you let go of one, you know, a game could take that as like a pointing gesture. Or if you have your thumb off of the thumbstick, it could have like a thumbs up gesture or something like that. What people use that for other than emotes and games is up to other people smarter than me. But I having used these controllers a few times, I will say that they're comfortable. They seem very good. And the tracking on them seem to be just fine. From my standpoint, there are still some people who believe that the active tracking of the HTC Vive controllers will be better than what Oculus Touch controllers can do, but we'll see. Just because the comparison or the potential pain point is the resolution of these two USB cameras at distance and room scale may start to lose some fidelity as you get further away from them. So it's interesting. They also announced that the built-in headphones on the Oculus Rift, you will, for $50, be able to buy replacements for those that are earbuds instead of just over-ear headphones, which should be interesting. They claimed that, you know, as they are companies like this are wont to do, claimed that they compared them to like $900 earbuds and that these sound better, as good or better than those. I don't think I believe that necessarily because there's 50 and fundamentally there has to be some physics reason for that. And I'm sure they're talking about those some kind of Shure in-ear earbuds and that type of stuff. But hey, for $50, if they sound great, fantastic. And the over-ear stuff has never really kind of sat with me very well. It was fine. And they at least are offering a second option for that. And then technologically, they announced a lowering of their hardware minimum hardware specification down to a GTX 960 instead of a GTX 970. And they were able to do that with the implementation of a technology they call Space Warp, which is – I'm still trying to figure out exactly what this is, but it seems very similar to Time Warp. Late Time Warp is a technology where it's like, okay, if the GPU didn't finish a new frame in time, the Oculus runtime takes this frame and shifts it a little bit based on the headset motion and tries to emulate where it thinks you would go and where you would move. Space Warp looks like it does the same thing essentially, but based on the last two frames of information. And it's built basically to allow games to run at 45 frames per second, but still output at 90 frames to the headset. Right, so every other frame would be warped, but every frame would be warped based on the two previous rendered frames. I assume what that does is it just basically gives them more information to interpolate how fast you're moving, how far it should move areas of the screen. With the name like Space Warp, it would seem to me like it may actually be shifting the 3D world some internally, but that seems like that would be a significantly more compute-intense application. As opposed to just shifting a 2D image around on your display. So I'm going to try to find out more about what that is, and we can talk about it next week if it's interesting. And I saw an interesting couple of notes on Twitter from Will Smith, previously at Tested, who commented that lowering of specification to a 960 with 45 frames per second target sounds almost exactly like what somebody would do if they were trying to target the Microsoft Scorpio platform next year for Oculus Rift support. So the theory is out there now that this is work that Oculus had to do in order to meet the hardware spec that Scorpio will have for Microsoft next Xbox platform so that they will have their own VR option as well. So could be interesting.
Good to know. You recently got to experiment with a ruggedized laptop. Was it truly rugged? Can you talk about it yet?
These are available and for sale. I actually have one here that they sent to me. So I'm in Panama City at the beach, and they said, "Hey, we're going to ship you some of these rugged laptops." And I said, "Well, this seems like a good place as any to do it." This is their 12-inch model. It's actually a convertible tablet. laptop, right? And you can, like, in terms of how rugged is rugged, you can drive a car over this screen with the screen side up. They did that in kind of one of their demonstration videos.
Have you driven a car over yet? I have not yet.
If you look at some of the pictures I put in the show notes, what I did do is I took it to the beach, and I like threw it in the sand. I buried it in the sand. I let the ocean water kind of come up and like rinse the salt water off of it. And then I let Emmeline play with it while she was building sandcastle-y type structures in there as well. And it continued to work through all of that. And then on my way back up to the condo, I took the freshwater hose and rinsed it all down and made sure I rinsed into the fan areas and stuff to test its ingress protection and everything. And it's here it is. It's still up and running. And it's a big, thick laptop. It's heavy. It's a Skylake base part. And you can see, like, it has all of its ports are kind of connected by, or protected rather, by these doors, right? Now, as I do that, there's probably still some sand down there in the corners. Yeah. So you can see all the ports on the, yeah, actually, I just threw sand. Sand is still coming out of this machine. But the important part is it still works and operates on it. And it is, a lot of sand coming out of there. So I don't have a whole lot of experience with these types of rugged devices. It's not, you know, my work field of work doesn't really demand it so much. But for fire departments, police departments, people that are doing geological surveys, people that are working outside a lot, people who are doing field engineering, who greatly depend on their machine. And like, if my laptop goes out, I could go to Best Buy that hour and get a new one if it's critical. When you're out in the field, you don't have that option, right? So that's what these types of machines are built for. Because they're expensive. This is probably a $4,000 to $5,000 machine. And in terms of performance and hardware specs, it's going to be like any kind of normal laptop. But the key is that it can do that while being thrown two stories to the ground, while it's being washed away into the sandy beach areas of Panama City.
Well, it's like any other tactical piece of hardware. You know, there are people who are going to buy it because they actually do. You know, if you are a 22-hour drive from the nearest place to pick up a shipment, and it may cost you $1,000 to get something shipped there, you really don't want your stuff to die. And then on the other end, there's, you know, somebody's like, well, I'm never going to break a computer again, and I've got the super, well, the Toughbook. I worked with somebody who would only carry Toughbooks. His only Toughbooks would stand up to his rigorous use, which was almost entirely in an office, where he left the laptop on weekends.
This machine is a fully rugged. They also have like what they call partially rugged, which is like another step down, where it's like they're not fully water resistant type of thing. And I'm getting one of those in too. So it'll be a little bit thinner, a little bit lighter. And I could see if the cost was reasonable, more reasonable, and then I don't know if they are yet, like that could be a laptop for a kid almost, right? But you probably don't want to invest that kind of money in a laptop for a kid like that. But, you know,
trust me,
Emmeline's 16 months old and she was like stepping and walking on it and like, you know, putting all of her weight on the screen of this and that type of stuff. I was like, no, I don't have any fear that anything's going to happen to it. Either.
This is not behavior you want to encourage. Trust me, as the man who lost an iPhone due to, you know, toddler drool while teething. It's one thing, you know, it's one thing if you actually have a ruggedized laptop and all you have are ruggedized laptops. But now she's going to think she can dance on any laptop screen like it's Dance Dance Revolution on Thursday afternoon after school.
That's a good
I'm
point.
Just saying.
Yeah, that's fair. So, I, as somebody who doesn't have any experience with this, I think it's pretty interesting, and we're going to put the series through some tests and just kind of demonstrate what you can do. And, you know, not that you have to do that to these machines, but that you could do that to these machines.
Throw some gear oil on it. Let's see what happens. Can you get gear oil off the screen? Will it work with gear oil? What happens to the keyboard if you get gear oil?
That's a place where you'd put one of these, like in a mechanic shop, right?
Yeah. I forwarded it out on Facebook. There was a magnificent post where somebody was, I don't know, in Czechoslovakia, Poland. I can't remember off the top of my head. But they found an actual Commodore 64 being used to run the business of a mechanic
shop
that had been there for like decades. So, you know,
It's impressive.
You never know what you're going to find in those those environments. And that is it for this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. You can find us each and every week here at twit.tv/TWICH, where you can also find all the information on how to subscribe. If you want to catch more of Ryan Schrout and the PC Per crew doing their PC Per hardware thing, do yourself a favor, go to PCPer.com. You can find myself and Shannon Snubs Morris each and every week on techthing.com. And I also do a podcast about home theater and headphones and music and entertainment and HD and 4K and all that stuff with Robert Heron, which you can find at avxl.com. Robert Heron, by the way, is going to be recording next with Scott Wilkinson, getting their home theater geeks on, I believe, doing a tag team calibration of a new television. That should be good stuff. You should check that out. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I gotta go catch an airplane. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrell.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.